My name is Dr. Matthew Ladner. I'm a senior advisor for research and policy at the Foundation for Excellence in Education, which most people don't know, but we like to call ourselves Team Jeb, or Jeb Bush's foundation. They're based in Tallahassee, Florida. I still live here in Phoenix, Arizona. And we're here today to talk about school choice. We have an extremely distinguished panel. I'm going to show you just a few slides as kind of an introduction, but I think, you know, just sort of as an introductory remark, the school choice movement was being written off as dead just 2-3 years ago, right? There were people writing articles. In fact, there was a Washington Monthly article that said, quote, 2008, vouchers are dead, right? This person took some, you know, sort of teacher union type of research summaries, popped it in there, talked about the reversal in Utah, the ballot referral, and basically said, this is it, you're done. Okay. So, my response to that, on the blog, as we started to pass programs again, and then we had the monstrously successful year this year, was to, on the blog, to put up a picture of, Truman holding up the newspaper that says, you know, Dewey defeats Truman, right? Really our movement is, it's an endurance test. And I like to compare it to, for instance, the civil rights movement, right? There were many, many, many times in the civil rights movement where they could have just given up, right? But they never did. They hung in there, they demonstrated their endurance, and they ultimately prevailed. Okay. We have three people with us today that have done exactly that in different ways in different spheres. So just to start off here, let me just show you some sort of a progress report on the school choice movement. So 2011 was simply unprecedented in terms of progress in the school choice movement. We saw major school choice victories across the country. For instance, the DC voucher program, which had been all but killed by the Obama administration, came roaring back. We saw innovative programs in Colorado and Arizona. We'll talk a little bit more about them. We saw new states coming onto the map. Even now, as we're speaking, there are significant school choice proposals advancing in the state of Pennsylvania. The sessions are not even up yet. So this is, quite frankly, far more progress than we've seen before. This is a slide from the Alliance for School Choice, basically showing you the number of students enrolled by year in what they call targeted school choice programs. Okay, so these tend to be programs that are either means tested for children below a certain income level or special needs programs or things like that. They don't tend to be things like tax credit programs which is actually a rarity that all kids can access. So you clearly see the growth there. And this is kind of a summary of all the different programs that passed this year. So this is really a record-breaking year. And so our three panelists, starting with Lisa Graham Keegan. Lisa is the former superintendent of public instruction here in Arizona and has gone to do a number of great things, a lot of which she's going to tell you about. But when Lisa was superintendent, right, Lisa always talked about having money follow the child, right? This is something that you continually talked about. It is still really the vision, in my opinion, of the school choice movement. We believe that money should follow the child to the school of the parent's choice. Lisa, tell us about, you know, your recent activities, what you did in the advance of all of this, this year, Education Breakthrough Network, School Choice Week. Mm-hmm. And all that stuff, and we'll get to some more questions in a moment.
Okay.
And this is yours.
Oh, so I can,
yes.
I can click
They're
that.
All together.
I'm probably going to do these backwards in a second. But first of all, thank you very much for coming to our beautiful Arizona, and in my case, for coming to my hood. I grew up a mile from here. So you can understand a child growing up in this atmosphere being unreasonably optimistic for a lifetime. And so if I evidence that, I blame the place. It's a beautiful place to be, and we're happy to have you here. What Matt is talking about is, in my case, 20 years of work on school choice, on school excellence via choices that families and children make, and, importantly, choices that teachers get to make in a world where they actually are running their own profession. And I think that's an aspect of school choice that rarely gets discussed. I think it's absolutely critical that what we're seeing in the school choice movement is the profession owning itself and offering itself into the marketplace. Is a very different model. And so, to me, it matters a great deal that this is being driven by educators, excellent educators themselves. Were they not bringing these things to market, we wouldn't have access to them. So that's 20 years. I want to talk about the period from 90 to now. And the fact that what we're in right now is a shift, a very real transformation that is going on. And I want to just give you some numbers, and I'm not going to put them up on the board, but the growth in the student population, K-12, public, private, everybody, growth has been about 19% of the student body in 20 years. We've grown about 19%. During that same time, the number of students who opted to go to their assigned school, just the one that they would be assigned to down the street, has grown 11%. So any of you who own businesses understand you've lost a little market share, not a small percentage. Meanwhile, school choices have grown approximately 70%. Now, first of all, if one becomes two, that's 100% gain. And lots of people say, well, yeah, but it's still very marginal. Indeed, very marginal, as was the first Model T compared to the number of horses on the road when they first came out. And so I would say that the persistence of this trend, if you plot it out, it's very real. In fact, it's inevitable. Choice, choosing to go to a school versus simply getting assigned to one, is the way of the future. We are in it right now as a transition. And the question is, how fast can we get there? Why did it go so fast? So fast. I feel like an old woman. I've been doing this for 20 years, and we're just now sort of breaking the margins. But anymore, 2011 was pretty fast, felt fast. But it was standing on the shoulders of two decades, at least, of solid work. So why? What happened? So let's talk a little bit about Arizona. So I've had the privilege of working on this issue in the legislature in Arizona beginning in 1991, and then got to be state school superintendent here, which was a great privilege for a couple of terms. What happened during that period of time, and then since I've left for the past 10 years, this has gone on continuously in Arizona. So Arizona was an early adopter of a lot of different kinds of choice. Arizona was an early adopter of saying that we're not going to regulate private schools. That matters. Matters a lot in terms of your ethos. We said we were going to let homeschooling be homeschooling in Arizona. Lots of places regulate it. We decided not to, and we made that decision a number of times during the 1990s. It was presented to us as an option not to do that. We refused to change the way we saw homeschooling. In 1994, Arizona was the first state in the union to pass public charter school law with a state board for public charter schools. Because up to that time, we'd been forcing local school districts who were not in the business of opening up new schools to open them up and say, look, if somebody wants a public charter school, you have to go to your school district first and basically say, yeah, I'd like a divorce from you guys because I don't think you're doing a good job. We'd like to be independent. That's just humanly a difficult thing to do. We actually got advice from folks in Colorado who passed their charter school law the year before we did, and our legislator friend said, you know, if we had it to do over, we'd create an independent board whose job it is to evaluate petitions for public charter schools. Arizona was the first in the country to do that, and that's part of the reason why Arizona moved so very quickly in the public charter school space, simply because we allowed ourselves to sort of meet the demand that was out there. So we were first to that game. We were also first to tuition tax credit scholarships. So scholarshiping is one of the reasons that we've had this kind of growth. It started in the private sector. It started with private individuals just saying, you know what, we're going to start raising money for private scholarships because it is morally, we cannot contemplate just leaving kids in schools that are poisonous. That's just unacceptable. We'll just raise money and allow kids to go to private schools. A lot of you are familiar with these private scholarshiping organizations. They've been gifts to the nation. They still exist. They also prompted the public scholarshiping programs. And in Arizona in 1997, our now congressman, Trent Franks, came up with an idea that was we would create a tax credit unique to individuals that would allow us to scholarship kids to schools. That was unique. That was, Arizona went first. Arizona, thanks to this gentleman sitting to my right, your left, this year brought us education savings accounts from the great mind of Matt Ladner, but another great option for how you develop the funds and the resources that will support kids into the school that they want to go to. All of this came sort of to a head in 2011. Matt's right. There were lots of articles in 10 and 9 and 10 about, you know, your school choice movement is dead. Well, the only reason he would say that is if you weren't looking at the data. That's just crazy. It was never dead. It was never dead, and demand is greater than ever. Public charter schools in the country are growing at an incredible rate. So at about, they grow overall, in Arizona, we're growing at about 10% a year. Meanwhile, school assignment in Arizona is down about 1% a year. So it reflects the national reality. So that's, anybody who said these things were dead, just were, they weren't paying attention. The issue was, how do you take all of these disparate efforts and brand them as a cause that everybody can be comfortable with? And the, okay, I want to go forward. I want to submit to you, this was, I did it.
You did?
Yes, look, there
okay.
we are.
There you are.
This was one of the catalytic events in Arizona and across the country. There's been a lot of work done on how we talk about ourselves as a movement. There are voucher supporters, scholarship supporters, public charter school supporters, homeschool supporters, and the big dog in this race is online learning. That evidences itself in private, charter, public, all of these places because it's very transformative. How do we talk about what we are? We're about choices. And in fact, the big divide in American education is not public to private. It's between choice and assignment. National School Choice Week was an effort. And if you've got this book, if you take a look and marvel at it, this was a first time effort to try to get ourselves on one page for the cause of the right to choose a school that works for you. 200 organizations, 150 events in 40 states, 34 million Americans reached through the press. This is a huge and booming movement if you can get it together. And I'll tell you, this meeting of a coalition in Arizona, Matt and I have both worked on school choice issues in Arizona for a long time. I'm a lot older than Matt, so I've been doing it longer. I'd never been in the same room with all these people until we had a common cause in a branding that is school choice writ large. That, I think, is incredibly important, that what we do now is that we recognize in different schools, and you can see all of the branding of the scarves, and in the legislature, in different places, that this moment that we're in, we can either say, well, it's going to happen, we'll just let it happen, or we brand it, we accelerate it, we get together, and we say we're going to go as fast as we can, because while the change is real, for too many kids on too many waiting lists, it's not accessible yet, and there are ways we can sell ourselves to the public in ways they understand and can be part of.
So Lisa, a question that I used to give when I was at the Goldwater Institute, people would say, well, Arizona leads the nation in school choice by some measures. We have the biggest percentage of kids going to charter schools.
Right.
But when you look at our public school results, they're
horrible.
Horrible. That's a good way to put it. Somewhat underwhelming, perhaps. A lot of room for improvement if we want to be nice. I want to get your reaction to that. I think we're entering into a really interesting phase here in Arizona, because up till now, it's basically been the case that school choice was kind of taking the edge off public school enrollment growth,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
For every kid that was going out to a charter school, there were three new kids coming into the system, right? Well, the enrollment growth has really tapered off, and you know the as market shares you referred
right.
to it earlier is really going up. So how do you see that going forward? Do you think that the sort of choice ethos has taken root here in Arizona and that people expect it and want it? Or do you think there will be pushback and retrenchment?
I think both, Matt. So I think choice is real and people want it, or you wouldn't have so much demand and so many waiting lists as we've got in Arizona for it, both in the private school choice and public school choice realm. The point of the exercise is excellent education. And as Matt points out, Arizona is persistently low in its expectation. This is a cultural reality in Arizona. It's been true since Arizona's inception almost. It's very difficult to tell Arizona what to do, how to do it, that you aren't doing it correctly. This is part of a miner's ethos. It's also the fact that women have always been more in power in Arizona than in lots of places. We don't like to be told what to do. We like to tell everybody else what to do. It's a very interesting sort of place in Arizona, and getting that standard raised, it's important. So why I think choice matters so much, because the contract we have with public charter schools is work well or we'll shut you down. We've got about 50 schools in Arizona that should be closed tomorrow, in my opinion, public charter schools. The deal was we'll bring you excellent performance or we'll go out of business. We need to keep up, those of us who are in leadership positions need to keep up our end of the bargain. Yeah, you're out of business. So that needs to happen, and I think that's a better culture for education, period.
Right.
So I worry greatly about the lack of rigor and sort of people wanting attainment. I once spoke in a high school where a principal stood up and said, I couldn't pass these math standards, and the parents applauded him. I wanted to quit my job that day. That's what you're up against, right? Because it was a suburban high school where the parents all thought the geraniums looked nice outside the school, and we must be just absolutely kicking it here.
Right.
So they didn't want to hear about an assessment that was going to tell them otherwise. And so it's a difficult environment to work in. And the goal is not one kind of school over another. It's that any school you would walk into would just be fighting for its excellence every day. And that's the kind of pressure I think that choice brings you.
Okay. Now, Alex Cranberg is, you can read his bio in the piece, but Alex has been sort of the prime mover in the state of Colorado in the choice movement for a number of years. And one of the things that I'm really impressed with about Alex and his team in Colorado is their just doggedness. Some years ago, there was a school voucher program passed in the state of Colorado. The usual suspects sued. I was actually there to see the arguments in the Colorado Supreme Court. And we did not prevail. And the decision of the Colorado Supreme Court basically hinged on the idea that there had to be local control of education, right? So this year, we see them, Alex and company, hoisting people on their own petard with a locally driven program. So, Alex, can you tell us about that and kind of tell us how you plan to sustain the momentum on this in the long run?
Sure. Thank you. We have the other D.C. voucher program, Douglas County. as Matt mentioned, the state Supreme Court ruled down the statewide voucher program, and we realized that we needed to kind of come at this and retool it several different ways. And one of those was looking at, basically being reminded amongst other people, the state Supreme Court, that local school districts in Colorado do have substantially more power than they do in many other states. There's only six states in the United States which have as much local district power as they do have in Colorado. So, you know, we weren't able to achieve any our aims in one way. We were working on the other. Douglas County is not an inner city school district with poor test results, but it's a wealthy suburban district. But surprise, surprise, there are children there whose potential is not being fully engaged by their schools, and there are parents that can't afford to send their kids to the schools that are able to engage their kids. And I think part of the reason the Douglas County program caught so much attention nationally was its reminder that this is not just an issue for low-income kids in inner-city schools. It's very much an issue for them, but it's an issue for all of us, especially in the wealthier Republican suburbs where people, as Lisa was suggesting, maybe a little bit overly complacent about their own results. A district judge put the Douglas County program in abeyance under challenge for our Blaine Amendment. Of course, these infamous and discriminatory Blaine Amendments are put school choice programs, voucher programs in particular, at risk throughout the country. And it's on that basis that Douglas County program is currently being challenged. Fortunately, all 500 slots, which were vastly oversubscribed for in Douglas County, were supported by the schools that the kids chose to go into. But I think, as Lisa was suggesting about Arizona, Colorado is also a state which has quite a history going back 15, 20 years. And I'm constantly reminded, one of my favorite phrases is about this inevitability that Lisa mentioned, that I know lots and lots of people who've gone from being against vouchers to being for them. And I don't know anybody who's gone the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a bad idea. Which suggests that it really is a matter not of if, but when. And we just have to work together in an integrated fashion with all the different kind of flavors of choice. Philanthropy is certainly one of the key starting points in each one of these pieces. Private, strong charter and private scholarship initiatives have gradually, over 15 years, built a constituency of knowledge amongst citizens and leaders and voters who kind of get a whole lot more than they did 15, 20 years ago. And that's a big asset in states where there's a long-term persistent effort. At the same time as some of these more out-of-the-system school choice efforts have taken place, at the flagship public district in Colorado, in Denver, there have been two business-oriented leaders. First, now Senator Michael Bennett, and then Tom Boasberg, who ran the Denver Public School District. Each of those leaders fortunately had no prior experience in K-12 to impair their judgment, and they've actually kind of taken a fresh look at realizing that choice can be an engine for innovation and excellence. And these are Democrat leaders who've pushed a choice charter agenda, not really with any influence from, certainly from me, or any of the standard school choice folks, mm-hmm. but they get it from a different direction. Between what they've done within the conventional school district and what we've done outside of that and with the charter groups, I think there's a broad cross-section of folks who normally not persuaded by Republican arguments about the relevance of market forces to education. So what's kind of created that progress and where are we going? The same point I'd make that Lisa did about the importance of bringing everybody together under one banner. We started an organization called Alliance for Choice in Education. People think about ACE as a private scholarship foundation first and foremost, and we are that. We had a big strategic internal debate. Are we just about lifeboats for the kids that are on some doomed ship, or are we, in addition to providing some lifeboats, about riding the ship? And after a spirited debate internally, our bulk of our trustees came down toward that latter course, which meant that we are about all these different, you know, about helping people understand that choice and competition, and by the way, we found out in some of our polling, the competition is not as negatively viewed an idea as some folks would have us believe. We go to choice as opposed to competition because people think it's a little less pungent, but we found at least that a lot of focus groups and polling, the competition did pretty well. People do kind of get that. But bringing all these, having that common theme among all the people that understand that this isn't about public versus private, it's not about charter versus non-charter, it's about choice, and what choice comes from access to choice, and which is basically involves money and these teachers and also knowledge. I think when you look at who has knowledge to create choices, that has tremendous power. I have a little different point of view than Lisa does about these 50 schools that aren't, quote, doing a good job. Because to me that smacks of somebody else telling, you know, why don't we telling the parents to leave those schools, informing them with knowledge about why those schools aren't so good, and a charter that has 20% of its kids leave probably isn't going to last very long. That there's a hesitance to actually market the way you would a product, to market your product against somebody else's. It's somehow impolite to say, well, that school's doing a bad job, and say it out in public to the customers of that school. But I wouldn't mind, you know, some efforts being taken along those lines. But that's one integration is of all these different efforts, but the other is of the types of efforts, political, charitable, and lobbying. You know, and philanthropy all too often is all about the charitable piece. But just because something qualifies for a tax deduction doesn't mean that it qualifies for being effective. That to be effective, because politics is the currency and the engine of public education, you got to play that game. And you can't play that game just in a C3 fashion. I think we can integrate it. You got to be willing to roll up your sleeves and play politics. And we played in school board elections. We failed in a couple of school board elections where we elected people that were pro-voucher that then flaked, but then we finally got, you know, a true blue school board that was willing to stand up for something. We've supported Democrats, inner-city Democrats. We've supported, and we've punished, very importantly, wayward Republicans. And I would just cite one particular example. I'm proud to say that in Colorado, for the last 8 years, there's not been a Republican elected to the state legislature who is not pro-voucher. And I'm not sure many states can say that. Most voucher initiatives have failed not because, in addition to the fact that not enough Democrats supported it, but because some Republicans have flaked out. And we punished one Republican who wanted, well, none of the people that voted against the Colorado voucher legislation were in office, certainly within 4 years, probably within 2 years. And we went ahead and defeated and worked toward defeating, the citizens defeated, a Republican who, in a general election, we didn't support her Democratic candidate, who was even worse than she was on the issues, but we did make sure everybody understood what this Republican's position was on the voucher bill, and she lost. And we took a bunch of grief for that, but it was something that was important to send a message. And since that time, I think the Republican Party has actually stood for something in school choice. Doesn't mean we've been able to pass something. When the day comes, we'll have the Republicans reasonably well aligned. The Alliance for Choice in Education at this point is pushing hard to be a unifying force. You know, we'd love to follow the example that Lisa mentioned about this school choice week. We want to catch people's attention with a new campaign that links knowledge and choice. And we're still working on it.
So,
but I've got a couple of billboards that were sort of thought pieces. Our first goal is we got to just get people's attention. And they're not, you know, necessarily politically correct, but we're kind of working with this concept of no, because knowledge being not it being one of these, knowledge and money are the two things required. To tie improvement and reform to knowledge about choices, create this unifying theme of choice and competition among the various different efforts. And Lisa and I did not coordinate our presentations here, so this is an idea. Try to catch people's attention, a billboard. And we're going to bring the point a little bit further home by something like, we disagree.
You looking for money for McDonald's?
This may not actually make it into the real world, but we're really happy to show it here. Put down school choice matters. I mean, I think that's the point we want to try to get across. We disagree, school choice matters.
Oh my gosh.
Alec!
Oh,
how shocking! Oh.
So how edgy we get, how edgy everybody feels comfortable with, we're not sure, but we want to, our model here is something similar to like the meth campaign where we want to get, kind of hit people over the head with something that kind of is disturbing. And probably how we'll know it's disturbing is we'll have a lot of spirited debate amongst our board as to which of these kind of things we could actually do. But we'll push the envelope, try to get people's attention, and try to draw them toward the point about school choice matters.
So, Alex, I mean, this is an entirely novel approach. No one has really done this before. I'm guessing that you're going to be trying to raise consciousness here. I mean, because, you know, an obvious response from the usual suspects is going to be to try to go in and take that school board back, right? I mean, so...
Yeah, someplace they can do it, someplace they can't. What happened in Douglas County, that is one of the most solidly Republican place in Colorado.
Okay.
And it was a bit controversial within the Republican Party to brand it because they're nonpartisan races in Colorado, but we did anyway, and it's pretty clear Republican versus Democrat, and that just doesn't go very far there. If this were in Denver, there is a big, highly contested school board election going on between the pro and anti-reformers. It's a very Democratic area where you got labor and other influences which are mixing up some of what should be the themes about educational excellence. And there would be a lot more difficult. It is a lot more difficult. There's millions of dollars going to be spent on that particular race. Mm-hmm. Douglas County, we're ready to put more money in if necessary. We haven't seen any attempt by the other side.
That's interesting. Okay. So... Fred, now those of you who don't know Fred is an entrepreneur and a businessman from Indiana. Indiana passed a mind-blowing set of education reforms this year, stunning in its sweep. You know, I, you know, part of what I do professionally is to celebrate the accomplishments of education reform in Florida. And I had to write after Fred and his compatriots were done that it is possible that Indiana has actually exceeded Florida in terms of the scale of the reforms. And this has all basically happened in the first last 2 years. And it's kind of going from stomping on the gas and going from 0 to 60 in 2.3 seconds, right? So, Fred, tell us, you know, I mean, for a long time, you know, just the whole Indiana experience reminds me of, Bonnie Raitt. I mean, some of you may remember the singer Bonnie Raitt when she reached the top of the charts in the late 1980s, you know, and someone's, you know, kind of asked her about it. And she said, well, it's great to be an overnight success. You know, it only took me 23 years exactly. of hard work to do it. So, Fred, tell us a little bit about what you got done in Indiana. You know, how you see, you know, things going forward and how you can sustain it over time.
So after listening to Alex and Lisa's presentation, I know why you put me last. Being the most controversial, as I think I will be before the end of my presentation, one way or the other. My wife tells me all the time I shouldn't talk about politics or religion over dinner, and I try to do that, but unfortunately in this presentation, I have to talk about politics as a starting point. And I'll make it about Indiana, not the rest of the country, because I live in Indiana and I can talk about my state and what I think about it. And you can consider this just my opinion about things like that. But in Indiana, the public education system has actually failed. And it's failed for decades. It doesn't mean there's not good schools, and it doesn't mean there's not good teachers. It doesn't mean there's not good people working very hard to try to deliver education. But you know, when 24,000 students are trapped in underperforming schools, when 25% of the kids don't graduate from high school, over 50% of the African American kids don't graduate from high school, not on this chart, 23,000 kids every year make it to the third grade in our public schools that can't read. Somehow when you look at these facts, at least as a businessman, you can't sit there and say, well, I think I can fix this. If 25% of my products are defective when they're manufactured and I still ship them to my customers, I don't stay in business very long as a for-profit business. And so it's no different. Education and delivering education, frankly, there's not a lot of magic to delivering good education. It takes basically a good teacher in a positive culture. And it's amazing what these charter schools and some of these private schools have done. Most of the private schools and charter schools I'm associated with have children reading in the first grade, let alone the second or third grade. So the premise of my presentation and what we've done is all about the fact that public education has changed and we need a new education delivery system. And the barrier to getting the new education delivery system is our political structure. And in Indiana, it's the Democrat House owned by the teachers union. The most powerful lobby in Indiana. In every election, they put up $1.2 million to selected Democrats in order to make sure that education reform doesn't even make it on the committee topic list, let alone be discussed either in committee on the open floor. So I want to talk to you about an organization we've evolved into. And before I do that, though, I've got to give a lot of credit to three organizations. The Friedman Foundation has been our education reform resource center and knowledge center and just have been unbelievable in bringing real knowledge about the reality of education reform and all the things that have succeeded in the rest of the country. So instead of having to look for it, it was just always there. The American Federation for Children provided all kinds of funding on the political side. While we raised a significant amount of money in Indiana, more than half of the money came from out of state, not just the American Federation, but the Walton Foundation also. If we talk about the organization on the left side, the Choice Charitable Trust, CCT, was formed by Pat Rooney 20 years ago. We've given away $20 million in individual scholarships for kids to go to private schools in the inner city. Let's assume we affected 1,000 kids a year. There are 1 million kids in school in Indiana, so 1,000 wasn't even a decimal point on the equation. So with the Friedman Foundation and Robert Enlow's help, we formed School Choice Indiana, SCI, as a C3, and we got all the non-public school organizations together as a board to talk about what policy should be for education in Indiana. So our political structure stopped having multiple initiatives handed to them, and instead they got one initiative that everybody got behind and supported. And as you know, the C4 part of this got involved in the political side. And again, the funding came both in-state and out-of-state. But finally, the organization that had to be in place to have any degree of success was a PAC that raised as much money as the teachers' union did. So we formed HEG in 2007 as a political PAC. And in 2008, we raised $600,000 to go against the $1.2 million that the teachers' union put up. Unfortunately, as a 56% Republican state, Obama actually carried Indiana in 08. And so while we were at 49 seats in the House hoping to get to 51, we ended up at 48. And somebody, I guess analytically that's a success. I don't know, it still seems like a failure to me. So we put the PAC together, and by the time we got to the last election, we finally were handing out the same amount of dollars as this most powerful union was. But in every case, we had everybody we gave money fill out a questionnaire. One of those questions was, would you support vouchers? Would you support scholarship tax credits? Would you support the kind of things that we would legislatively expect you to? And if you did, then we helped you with your campaign. The bills that were passed, and I'll talk about in a little more detail, with 60 seats in the House, which is what we ended up winning in the last election in 2010, we went from 48 seats to 60. We hoped to get to 54. Overwhelming success. We also ended up with a supermajority in the Senate. In 2008, we actually elected one of the stronger superintendents of public education in the United States today, Dr. Tony Bennett. Talk about a guy getting out front and taking the blows every day for every kid in the state of Indiana. He has done just an unbelievable job. If you look at stated goals, this was the five-year strategy that we put together in 2007. So when you look at your state, if your state has a similar problem with a Democrat House and with the teachers' union, if you don't attack that problem, you by definition cannot be successful. You may get some bits and pieces done. I remember one political person who I have a high respect for telling me about how she was chipping away at the teachers' union. Well, my idea of chipping has a hammer in my hand, not a toothpick. So we set up our goals for 2008, 2009, 10, and 11. And at the end of that, we ended up with Republican Governor Mitch Daniels, who has been superb on education reform. Tony Bennett is Superintendent of Public Instruction. The lady Republican that preceded him refused to tell the truth about the reality of public education. If you listen to her, things were really good and getting better. And that was just nonsense. We ended up with 60 seats in the House, and we ended up with a supermajority in the Senate. And now we're going to elect a new governor. Mitch's term is up next year. And Congressman Mike Pence is running for governor, and we fully expect him to be our next governor and continue what we're doing. The legislation that was passed is quite unbelievable. It exceeded everything we thought we might do in 07, in 11. This exceeded that. To net it out, I'll let you look through the whole chart. There's five bills. Two of them are collective bargaining agreements. That for the first time in Indiana, if there's a layoff of teachers, we actually lay off the worst performing teacher, not the youngest. The second thing we can do in Indiana that we've never done before, if you're a really great teacher, we can give you incentive pay. You don't have to make the same amount of money if you're really better. And so if you can, on one hand, dismiss the ones that shouldn't be there, and on the other hand, pay the ones that should be there more money, seems like that might be a more positive cultural environment. We also enhanced our existing charter legislation. We have 50 schools in the state today. That could easily double in the next 2 years. And lastly, we passed the voucher bill. And with the vouchers, interesting challenge here. I would tell you that if your first challenge in your state is legislatively, because if you don't pass new legislation, the current legislation won't let you do what you want to do. The next thing then is to know the policy that you need to create and pass. And then the third step is, and now we're into this phase, once you pass that legislation, you have to execute it. So for example, on this voucher bill, passed April 30th, the rules were finally published in mid-July, our School Choice Indiana, one of our organizations, spent $700,000 communicating by mail, by email, and knocking on doors with targeted families of four, $60,000 of income and less, to be sure they understand how to sign up for a voucher. In 6 weeks, we signed up 4,000 kids for vouchers. The last bill, by the way, I talked about a fifth. The budget bill is an interesting thing, too, and I suspect in all your states this may be happening today, which just is amazing to me. We actually have something called a degoster. We used to. Number 11 on this list is we got rid of the degoster. What that meant was when a child transferred from one public school to the other one, the new public school got tuition reimbursement from the state, but the state continued to reimburse the old school for 3 years because, my golly, how could you possibly take money away from them? Instead, you'd give it to them even though there were no children there. So I'm going to show you a chart in a minute in terms of what the net impact of that was. Then I would tell you, this isn't cheap. So I can't see, is this the January? Yeah, it is.
Fundraising impact.
So it took about $5 million last year to make all this happen. We had the $1.2 million in the HEG PAC. In School Choice Indiana, the Association of Non-Public Schools, $250,000 of operational efforts, $700,000 to get the voucher program off the ground. Choice Charitable Trust, we raised $1 million and gave out scholarships under a 50% tax credit program. SCIN is where we write our policy goals for our House and Senate. That has been merged now with HEG, and it's now called the Hoosiers for Economic Growth Network. Aiming Higher was the governor's pack, but our partners ended up putting up $600,000 of the $1.2 million that was raised there. So in our collective organization, it took about $5 million last year. For this next election, we hope to probably raise about $7 million. Last chart that let me just talk about two things. We actually ended up having, we had an education rally down at our state house in 2010, and we had about 60 people show up. In 2012, there were 1,000 union people showed up, 2010. 1,000 union people showed up to lobby against the right to work bill that never got passed, but they tried to. So 3 weeks later, we had 1,000 parents show up at the state house to rally for the education reform legislation. Major impact. 10 or 20 voters can change the opinion of a legislator. 1,000 makes it really difficult for them to sleep at night. And if anybody shouldn't sleep, it would be our political people that have not yet passed the legislation they should pass. And then is this last chart?
Tony.
Is Dr. Tony Bennett. And I've already talked about Tony. If you do not have a superintendent of public education that will absolutely not accept anything that's bad for children. Say it a different way. If it's good for children, we'll do it. If it's not good for children, we will not do it. The governor can think about this an hour a week, a half a day a week, every other week. He needs somebody that 24/7 lives and breathes and executes what needs to be executed for an education reform legislation. Tony is just... just unbelievable. And for all of you, and some of you have met him, he's actually an ex-basketball coach. That explains part of his personality.
Mm-hmm. And a school superintendent.
So he's been there and done that. Then lastly, I put this chart up. You guys have all heard the statement, well, you can't take money away from schools because that will cause their education to be worse. In many cases, it couldn't be any worse, so that's not really valid. But you see here that the tuition support actually dropped over the last couple of years, and when you look at that in 2010 and now in 11, part of that's driven by this DeGoster going away. So it's not that we put more money into education, we just stopped paying two schools for one kid. And yet, look at performance. How did it go up? Well, the lines are not connected. They went up because of Tony and the effort, where now superintendents and school corporations might be fearing their jobs a little bit, and they might have to go home at night and say, maybe we better do a better job. Maybe we ought to deliver a better education or else. And at the end of the day, what I think we've done as businessmen who are not political, we don't have anything personally to gain other than, I don't know about you, but I'm at a stage in life where bad education is unacceptable. It must stop, and it must stop now, and we're not going to wait a decade to do it.
Great. So, Fred, I mean, when I look at that list of reforms that you guys did, what I see, you know, if I were to summarize the whole of Milton Friedman in one sentence, and you could say, why are the Detroit public school system so bad? I think Milton could summarize it and say, because it can be.
That's right. Right?
The fact that it can be is a necessary condition for it having the kind of catastrophic failure that we see, right? So when I look at your list, I see parental choice. That's a bottom-up way to put pressure on the schools to improve. I see you getting rid of ghost students so that it bites in real time rather than 3 years down the road. I see you grading schools A through F to provide transparency and to make parents aware of you know what's actually going on in their schools. We've done this in Arizona. We're starting to implement it now. Every time I drive to the airport, I drive past an elementary school with a gigantic banner out in front of it that says, "We are a performing school." And what they forget to tell you is that performing is the second lowest ranking you can possibly get, and it's the equivalent of a D.
Right.
Right. So, you know, on down your list, I saw your Governor Daniels talk at the American, at AEI, and he was talking about how Indiana used to do their testing in the fall and had their elections and school elections in the spring, right? And he said, well, I looked at this and I said, why in the world would anyone do accountability testing in the fall? The kids are just back from summer vacation. And then he said, oh, well, then I figured it out, right? So we can't assign the results to any particular teacher.
Right.
Right. In the spring, why do we have school elections in the spring? Only 10% of people show up. And he said, well, okay, but that's why we do it there. So we switched them. Right. We do our testing in the spring, do our elections in the fall. We'll see whether that makes a difference or not. Right. So I see all of these reforms having a thematic element, and that theme is very clearly focused on improving results in the public school. Do you see it the same way? Do you see these things kind of having a cumulative effect?
Yeah, there's actually two issues. The first we've been talking about, and that is there are good public schools. This is not necessarily condemning public schools. I'm condemning the public school system. The education delivery system is flawed. The culture is not good. The way they go about it's not good. There's just all kinds of issues. That said, though, there are good public schools. There are good charter schools. There are good private schools. Why wouldn't we want our children to have an option to select and have them go wherever they can get the best education? And if the state doesn't deliver options, choices, shame on that state. You must deliver the choices, because somewhere out there the lines cross. Especially if you can change the delivery system, which is the second thing that I'm concerned about, the lines cross, and some of those public schools actually get really good, right? Because now they know they have to.
Right.
And if you think about the education delivery system, the online options that are around today, how many of those have been explored for public schools as opposed for standalone private charter schools? They're going to it, but how much of that's rolled over into the public school system? So not only do we exist in a monopoly, the public school system, that monopoly rejects anything new, creative, productive. Good ideas are not allowed to survive.
Right. Let me throw out a question to all three of you and see who bites. But my mentor has been Jay Green through the years, and last year Jay made what I thought was an interesting analogy. He said that obviously there are a lot of other problems, and we shouldn't single them out exclusively. But the teacher unions obviously are basically opposed to every single thing on your list and Lisa's list and Alex's list. Jay basically made the argument that as we see a lot more support for serious reform ideas on both the right and the left, right, which is kind of, I believe over the last 5 years has been a novel development, he attributes that to the teacher unions morphing slowly into big tobacco. Right? He says, big tobacco is still very strong. They're still very powerful. You know, they can hire all the lobbyists they want. It's just people don't believe them anymore. If they get up and claim that smoking doesn't cause cancer, no one's buying it anymore. Mm-hmm. Right? How do you see the sort of longer term going forward and as we pursue kind of broad education reform? How do you see the possibility of getting more bipartisan support for things like parental choice, but also for all these other education reforms?
Well, I think our friend Darrell Bradford would say school choice is the cool choice, right? So one of the things that's happening now is that younger people are getting involved in school choice in ways that are hip, cool, all these sorts of, you've got rappers out there in New Jersey for school choice. As far as the union goes, I think it's an interesting phenomenon. So in Arizona, for example, the NEA is our affiliate, is our big union here. Fewer than 50% of our teachers affiliate with the union, and fewer than 50% of the members of the union are teachers. So they're largely a servicing organization. You know, they got the service staff, kitchen staff, bus drivers, et cetera, is the majority of that organization now. They've got themselves in a very difficult position. I never don't pay attention to somebody who's got 10 times the money that everybody else has. I mean, it makes you, unfortunately, it does make you big tobacco. It makes you lazy. It makes you, you just don't think you have to rethink your position. You just have all the power in the room. You kind of suck the air out of the room. That is not going to remain true for them, I think. I think a lot of the, initiatives that are coming are going to defund these sort of automatic payments and things like that that have happened for the union, Matt. I think the trick when I think about it, because I really think this is about a shift in the profession. So things like Teach for America are hugely important. Recruiting different thinking at the get-go. So most folks in Teach for America don't want to operate under a 100-page contract that says I can't work more than X amount of time. They want to excel. You know, these success junkies that are used to being obnoxiously successful their entire life. They get into teaching. They want to keep that culture going. So I was at the charter school authorizers last week sitting with Steve Barr, who works with unions in his charter schools, and Howard Fuller, who was part of, the civil rights movement forever. And I think the three of us just sort of said, look, it's hard to know who's flat out against you, except when you're in an individual battle and you know, and then you have to go up against them in the way that Fred's talking to me. Don't be confused. Right. But I do think there's a shift, and I think you have to acknowledge it, push it, and most importantly, push those organizations whose culture is the antithesis of what we've seen, in the bulky, unwilling, unchangeable union force.
Yeah, Fred. One thing I've heard Dr. Bennett talk about, and I think maybe has been a missing piece from the education reform menu for too long, is he actually makes a really compelling argument that those of us who have supported greater parental choice as a method to improve public schools have been negligent in ignoring the impact of collective bargaining in stymieing that, right? He says, yes, you can have, parents walking away from schools and money following them, but, if that big district is still governed by a 100-page contract like Lisa was talking about, the response could be somewhat less than you had hoped. So do you view it the same way, and do you see this as something that nationally other reform groups ought to be looking at more aggressively?
So the reality of what happens in that local school corporation in that local school district in rural Indiana is the most influential people in that community are the superintendent, the principal, and the teachers. And they may or may not be affected by choice because there may not even be another private school there. And so they worry about how the budget dollars are allocated and how they actually do their job. I just give you that as an example. There are a set of issues that within this monopoly that they've all had to deal with for 30 years, and they're all focused on dealing with it. So to ask them to stand back and conceive this whole new approach without a union, with some of the better techniques for delivering education and what it could be, is asking an awful lot. There is an evolution of change that must happen. The good news is we're right, and we will prevail because we are right about this when you have so many kids not getting an adequate education. On your point, though, about in Indiana, about the Democrat Party, the Democrats cannot vote for education reform while they're getting most of their money from the teachers' union to run and be elected. And so it's either a Republican-controlled House or it's a Democrat-controlled House. If it's Democrat, everything I'm doing can't happen. Now, Florida may be a great example, though. 8 or 10 years later, there is bipartisan support now in Florida. And even with Democrat control more than there has been. And so evolutionary, when we get to a point where everybody accepts charter schools and other options as being valid ways to provide education, then I think we can get a bipartisan. But to initiate it and get to some point where you know it's going to be around, it's not.
Okay. All right. Please join me in thanking our panel.
So I do have one last thing, and I know I'm going to get kicked off the panel for doing this, but the question on teachers, we didn't really complete the answer that I think is necessary. The second group of people that will benefit the most from education reform and choice is teachers. We are going to reestablish that as the profession it used to be and needs to be again. And what that means is the good teachers ought to be celebrated, and those that aren't doing so well in teaching need to find another job.